At the very last moment, when violence and inevitable death were only a heartbeat away, and rage was as thick in the air as the static electricity of the wildest summer thunderstorm, Moses Garma stopped dancing abruptly, posing like a heroic statue before them. And so great was the force of his personality, so striking his presence, that the drumming of shields and the growl of battle rage died away. Into the silence, Moses Garma called in the Zulu language, "I bring the marriage price!" And he held his stick aloft, a signal to the herd boys who followed the marriage party. Lowing and bawling, adding their dust to the dust of the dancers, the herd was driven forward, and immediately the mood of the Zulus changed. For 1,000 years since they had come down from the far north, following the tsetse fly-free corridors down the continent with their herds, the Nguni peoples, from which the Zulu tribe would emerge under the Black Emperor Shaka, had been cattlemen. Their animals were their wealth and their treasure. They loved battle as other men love women and children. Almost from the day they could walk unaided, the boys tended the herds, living with them in the veld from dawn to dusk of every day, establishing with them a bond, an almost mystic communion, protecting them from predators with their very lives, talking to them and handling them, and coming to know them completely. It was said that King Shaka knew every individual beast in his royal herds, and that out of 100,000 head he would know immediately if one were missing, and would ask for it with a complete description, and not hesitate to order his executioners with their knobkerries to dash out the brains of even the youngest herd boy, if there was even a suspicion of his negligence. So it was a committee of strict and expert judges who put aside the dancing and posturing and boasting, and instead applied themselves to the serious business of appraising the bride price. Each animal was dragged from the herd, and amid a buzz of comment and speculation and argument, was minutely examined. Its limbs and trunk were palpated by dozens of hands simultaneously. Its jaws were forced open to expose the teeth and tongue, its head twisted so that its ears and nostrils could be peered into, its udders stroked and weighed in the palm, its tail lifted to estimate its calf-bearing history and potential. Then, finally, almost reluctantly, each animal was declared acceptable by old Sangani Dinizulu himself, the father of the bride. No matter how hard they tried, they could find no grounds for rejecting a single animal. The Avambu and the Xhosa love their cattle every bit as much as the Zulu, and are as expert in their judgment. Moses and Hendrik had exercised all their skills in making their selection, for pride and honour were at stake. It took many hours for every one of the 200 animals to be examined, while the bridegroom's party, still keeping aloof from the Zulus, squatted in the short grass on the side of the road, pretending indifference to the proceedings. The sun was hot, and the dust aggravated the men's thirst, but no refreshment was offered while the scrutiny went on. Then at last Sangani Dinizulu, his silver pate shining in the sun, but his body still upright and regal, called his herd boys. Joseph Dinizulu came forward. As the senior herdsman, the old man gave the herd into his care. Although his exhortations were severe, and he scowled most ferociously, the old man's affection for his youngest son was ill-concealed, as was his delight at the quality of the stock which made up the marriage price. So when he turned, and for the first time greeted his future son-in-law, he was having great difficulty in suppressing his smiles. They kept shooting out like beams of sunlight through cloud holes, and were just as swiftly extinguished. With dignity he embraced Moses Garma, and though he was a tall man, he had to reach up to do so. Then he stepped back and clapped his hands, calling to the small party of young women who were sitting a little way off. Now they rose and helped each other to settle the enormous clay pots of beer upon each other's heads. Then they formed a line and came forward, singing and undulating their hips, although their heads remained steady and not a drop slopped over the rims of the pots. They were all unmarried girls. None of them wore the high clay headdress or the matron's leather cloak, and above their short beaded skirts their bodies were oiled and stark naked, so their pert young breasts joggled and bounced to the rhythm of the song of welcome, and the wedding guests murmured and smiled appreciatively. Although deep down old Sangani Dinizulu disapproved of marriage outside the tribe of Zulu, the Lobolo had been good, and his future son-in-law was, by all accounts, a man of stature and importance. None could reasonably object to suitors of this calibre. And as there might be others like him in the bridegroom's party, Sangani was not loath to show off his wares. The girls knelt in front of the guests, hanging their heads and averting their eyes shyly. Giggling in response to the knowing looks and sly sallies of the men, they proffered the brimming beer pots and then withdrew, swinging their hips so their skirts swirled up and pert young buttocks peeped provocatively from beneath them. The beer pots were so heavy that they required both hands to lift, and when they were lowered, there were thick white moustaches on the upper lips of the guests. Noisily they licked them away, and the laughter became more relaxed and friendly. When the beer pots were empty, Sangani Dinizulu stood before them and made a short speech of welcome. Then they formed up again and started up the road that climbed the escarpment. But now Zulu ran shoulder to shoulder with Avambu and Khoza. Moses Gama had never believed he would see that happen. It was a beginning, he thought. A fine beginning, but there remained to be scaled a range of endeavour as high as the peaks of the Drakensberg Mountains, which rose out of the blue distances before them as they topped the escarpment. Sangani Dinizulu had set the pace up the slope, although he must be all of 70 years of age, and now he led the cavalcade of men and animals down to his kraal. It was sited on a grassy slope above the river. The huts of his many wives were arranged in a circle, beehives of smooth thatch, each with an entrance so low that a man must stoop to enter. In the centre of the circle was the old man's hut. It also was a perfect beehive, but much grander than the others, and the thatch had been plaited into intricate patterns. It was the home of a chieftain of Zulu, a son of the heavens. On the grassy slope was assembled a multitude, 1,000 or more of the most important men of the tribe, with all their senior wives. Many of them had travelled for days to be here, and they squatted in clumps and clusters down the slope, each chieftain surrounded by his own retainers. When the bridegroom's party came over the crest, they rose as one man, shouting their greetings and drumming their shields, and Sangani Dinizulu led them down to the entrance of the kraal, where he paused and spread his arms for silence. The wedding guests settled down again, comfortably in the grass. Only the chieftains sat on their carved stools of office, and while the young girls carried the beer pots amongst them, Sangani Dinizulu made his wedding speech. First he related the history of the tribe, and particularly of his own clan of Dinizulu. He recited their battle honours and the valiant deeds of his ancestors. These were many, and it took a long time, but the guests were well content, for the black beer pots were replenished as swiftly as they were emptied, and although the old ones knew the history of the tribe as intimately as did Sangani Dinizulu, its repetition gave them endless satisfaction, as though it were an anchor in the restless sea of life. As long as the history and the customs persisted, the tribe was secure. At last Sangani Dinizulu was done, and in a voice that was hoarse and scratchy, he ended, "There are those amongst you who have queried the wisdom of a daughter of Zulu marrying with a man of another tribe. I respect these views, for I also have been consumed by doubts and have pondered long and seriously." Now the older heads in the congregation were nodding, and a few hostile glances were shot at the bridegroom's party. But Sangani Dinizulu went on. "I had these same doubts when my daughter asked my permission to leave the hut of her mother and journey to Igoldi, the place of the gold, and to work in the great hospital at Baragwanath. Now I am persuaded that what she has done was right and proper. She is a daughter of which an old man can be proud. She is a woman of the future." He faced his peers calmly and resolutely, seeing the doubt on their eyes, but ignoring it. "The man who will be her husband is not of Zulu, but he also is a man of the future. Most of you have heard his name. You know him as a man of force and power, I am persuaded that by giving him my daughter in marriage, I am once again doing what is right, for my daughter and for the tribe." When the old man sat down on his stool, they were silent, serious and withdrawn, and they looked uneasily towards the bridegroom, where he squatted at the head of his party. Moses Gama rose to his feet and strode up the slope from where he could look down upon them. He was silhouetted against the sky, his height was emphasized, and the royal leopard skin declared his lineage. "O people of Zulu, I greet you," the deep, thrilling voice reached to every one of them, carrying clearly in the silence, and they stirred and murmured with surprise as they realized that he was speaking fluent Zulu. "I have come to take one of the most comely daughters of your tribe, but as part of the marriage price, I bring you a dream and a promise," he began. And they were attentive but puzzled. Slowly the mood changed as he went on to set out his vision for them, a unification of the tribes and a sloughing off of the white domination under which they had existed for 300 years. The older men became more and more uneasy as they listened. They shook their heads and exchanged angry glances. Some of them muttered aloud, an unusual discourtesy towards an important guest. But what he was suggesting was a destruction of the old ways, a denial of the customs and orders of society which had held together the fabric of their lives. In its place he was offering something strange and untested, a world turned upside down, a chaos in which old values and proven codes were discarded with nothing to replace them except wild words. And like all old men, they were afraid of change. With the younger men it was different. They listened, and his words warmed them like the flames of the campfire in the frosty winter night. One of them listened more intently than all the rest. Joseph Dinizulu was not yet 14 years of age, but the blood of great Shaka charged his veins and pumped up his heart. These words, strange at first, began to sing in his head like one of the old fighting chants, and his breath came quicker as he heard Moses Gama end his bridal speech. "So, people of Zulu, I come to give you back the land of your fathers. I come to give you the promise that once again a black man will rule in Africa, and that as surely as tomorrow's sun will rise, the future belongs to us." All of a sudden, Joseph Dinizulu was struck by a sense of destiny. A black man will rule in Africa. For Joseph Dinizulu, as for many others there that day, the world would never be the same again. Victoria Dinizulu waited in her mother's hut. She sat on the earthen floor with a tanned kaross of hyrax fur under her. She wore the traditional dress of a Zulu bride. The beadwork had been sewn by her mother and her sisters, intricate and beautiful, each pattern carrying a hidden message. There were strings of coloured beads around her wrists and her ankles, and necklaces of beads, while her short skirt of leather strips was beaded and strings of beads were plaited into her hair and draped around her waist. In one respect only did her costume differ from that of the traditional Zulu bride. Her breasts were covered, as they had been since puberty, when she had been baptized into the Anglican Church. She wore a blouse of striped silk in gay colours, which complemented the rest of her costume. As she sat in the centre of the hut, she listened intently to the voice of her bridegroom from without. It carried clearly to her, though she had to shush the other girls when they whispered and giggled. Every word struck her with the force of an arrow, and she felt her love and duty for the man who uttered them swell until they threatened to choke her. The interior of the hut was gloomy as an ancient cathedral, for there were no windows, and the air was hazy with wood smoke that uncoiled lazily from the central fire and rose to the small hole in the summit of the belled roof. The cathedral atmosphere enhanced her mood of reverence, and when the voice of Moses Gama ceased, the silence seemed to enter her heart. No cheers or shouted agreement followed the speech. The men of Zulu were silent and disturbed by it. Victoria could feel it even where she sat in the darkened hut. "It is time now," her mother whispered, and lifted her to her feet. "Go with God," she whispered, for her mother was a Christian, and had introduced her to that religion. "Be a good wife to this man," she instructed, and led her to the entrance of the hut. She stepped outside into the dazzling sunlight. This was the moment for which the guests had been waiting, and when they saw how beautiful she was, they roared like bulls and drummed their shields. Her father came to greet her and lead her to the carved ebony stool at the entrance of the kraal, so that the chimenza ceremony could begin. The chimenza was the closing of the eyes, and Victoria sat with her eyes tightly closed as the representatives of the various clans came forward one at a time to place their gift before her. Only then was Victoria allowed to open her eyes and exclaim in wonder at the generosity of the givers. There were gifts of pots and blankets and ornaments, marvellously woven beadwork, and envelopes of money. Shrewdly, old Sangani calculated the value of each as he stood behind her stool, and he was grinning with satisfaction when at last he gave the signal to his son Joseph to drive in the feast. He had set aside 12 fat steers for the slaughter, a gesture that proved him to be even more generous than the bearers of the wedding gifts. But then he was a great man, and head of a noble clan. The chosen warriors came forward to slaughter the steers, and their mournful death bellows and the rank smell of fresh blood in the dust soon gave way to the aroma from the cooking fires that drifted blue smoke across the hillside.